He shot the Sharif, but he did not shoot him dead, you see. So...
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
Is dead.
Yes. Why?
This is my well.
I have drunk from it.
You are welcome.
Hello, everybody. Boy, Aaron's got the fidget spinner going already at the beginning of the show. Way to go, man. Mm-hmm. This is episode 125 of Recotopia. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by the aforementioned Aaron Dicer.
Hidely-ho, Lawrence Arenos.
Aha, there we go. And we'd like to welcome chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you guys for coming out. Aaron, do you have any small recommends?
Sure. Yes, I do.
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Let's start off with Twisters. Just out recently, and boy, did I have a good time at this movie. This is a kick of nostalgia in all the right ways for me, because it's not dependent necessarily on what is South Park call it, the member berries, you know, effect,
right,
where it's just like, remember this thing? Like, this is one of those, you know, franchise reboots that just isn't as interested in, like, you know, it. There's no we've got cows moment in this movie, let's just say. You know what I mean? Like, it's not interested in rehashing the actual, like, hey, you remember this thing? But what it is interested in rehashing is the way 90s blockbusters made you feel and how you got invested in these characters. It's interesting. I've been thinking a lot about this and why I loved this movie so much. But in the 80s, action movies, action blockbusters, summer blockbusters were like big meaty dudes blowing people away, right? Like, it was, you know, Schwarzenegger and Van Damme and, you know, whatever the case may be. And some of that bled into the 90s for sure. But then I think with, like, things like Independence Day, Jurassic Park, you know, some of these things in the 90s, it became kind of about, like, normal people in extraordinary situations surviving. And that's what this movie is in many ways. It kind of harkens back to that old school feel. And, man, I just had such a good time. It really helps that the chemistry of all these people is great. The structure of this movie is really great. It just, you know, it's like... cold open, meet the gang, set piece, big story movement, another set piece. You know, like, it just, it goes from one thing to another perfectly and just takes you where you need to go. I just had a blast with this movie. Highly recommend it. It's really fun.
I haven't seen it. It was obviously a big movie when I was first getting through movie theaters in the 90s. Was one of my... I guess my second year of projection when Twister came out, but like it's undeniable how big of an influence Twister has, not only on a lot of the blockbusters of the 90s. Of course, a lot of stuff came out that just kind of did that, but it had a lot of impact on what came out in the 90s, and then I think it even has resonance today, because even in comic book movies and things like that, because there's a disaster element to all of those, all of those movies and everything. So I think they've kept up that whole formula since then in some way, even if it's the tiniest of blueprints. But I've heard a lot of good things about this movie. So
and I've really enjoyed too going back and watching some of the OG disaster movies like Airplane or Towering Inferno and those kind of things, which is that kind of feel, like normal people in an extraordinary, you know, Poseidon Adventure is a great example of this. So I just think it's a formula that really works, and glad to see it put on the screen. So yeah.
I'm going to start off with a TV series that I know both of us have watched. It's the third season of The Bear, which has, when it first launched, I think it was June 26th that the whole season dropped. a lot of people were down on it. And especially after that first episode, which is basically a sort of a rehash of a lot of things. There's not really much dialogue or anything like that. It's kind of a summary of what's going on with our main character's psyche, essentially. What in the world has led us to this point in his career as a chef and everything? And I can see why a lot of people have been down on this season, but I think it's a very strong season. I don't know how it ranks with the other two, but I think it's a very strong season. I think that setting that whole thing up, what drives a person to be obsessed like Carmen is in this series, has just kind of sets the tone for the entire run of the third season. And so, yeah, there's not much in the way of advancing the story. Like, basically the story is, you know, they've revamped the restaurant. They're trying to do something new every day. They're not making too much money. That's the story of what's going on in the Bear. Everything else is character driven at this point. And so there are a couple of standout episodes in this one involving, is she a line cook, Tina?
Yeah.
Who it explains how she got to the Bear. That episode is phenomenal.
It's so
there's
good.
There's also the one involving the sister, like Natalie, who is pregnant, and one episode goes out to get these napkins or whatever, and then she goes into labor while she's getting all these restaurant supplies, leading to another episode with Jamie Lee Curtis, who looks like she's going for another Emmy on that one. Another great standalone episode. So a lot of this is like standalone character episodes and not much in the way of advancement of what's going on. And by the end of it, when Carmen finds one of the sources of his just angst and his anxiety and everything like that, and finally gets to confront that person, played by Joel McHale, who you've seen before, the answer that he gets back is so true to life and exactly what you can't expect any more than that and everything. But I thought this was a really well done season, even though a lot of people were down on it. I can see why they were, but I really did think this was still on par with the other two seasons.
Yeah, I don't know if you went back and kind of read my thoughts. I posted on our work Slack some of my thoughts.
I've been meaning to.
after watching the whole season. And I am one of those that's a bit down on this season, but not in the way of like, what a terrible season of television. No, this is better than 95% of the things on TV. You know what I mean? Maybe even more than that. It still may be the best show on TV, even with a down season, because they are making such interesting artistic choices. After I posted that, and I'll say just a couple of the reasons why it's a down season for me, but I did find out that this was apparently one of those pressure situations where they were told they needed two more seasons, not just one, kind of a negotiation where they had like the story they were ready to wrap up, but they were like, can we please stretch this for, you know, give us two more seasons of content and not just one. And so that is probably the reason it feels like it's spinning its wheels a little bit, is because it is. It's kind of delaying getting to the meaty stuff that they're going to get to in the final season. And that's okay, because, again, they're doing it in such a beautiful, artistic way. The only other thing aside from the spinning its wheels thing, which we've mentioned enough, is I think John Cena is so completely miscast in this season. He is such a distraction every time he's on screen. And for all the spinning the wheels the show does, we spend so much time with the Fack brothers, and it's fine. Yeah. They're good comic relief, whatever. I get it. But like, there are characters I love that have barely any moments this season. Tina's not one of them. She has an incredible episode. But I think of the dessert chef, which, you know, his whole story is basically that he's mourning the loss from last season. And I think he's starting to study magic and those kind of things. But that never really goes anywhere yet. And I love that character. So it just kind of felt like a you know, kind of perfunctory, let's kind of move this along kind of season for me. But I did love that Tina episode, and I love that Joel McHale conversation, which I just thought was so good. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. All right. My second small recommend is going to be Kung Fu Hustle.
Ooh, nice. Which was a big recommend a few months ago. I don't know how long ago.
I think it must have been more than a few months ago because I hadn't seen this yet. Sure. So, but
It must have been. I think it was just before I went on my hiatus. We did this one as a big recommend. But anyway,
yeah. And I was vaguely aware of that, and I think that's one of the reasons I had it so high on my watch list. And I'm here just to echo all the wonderful things that have been said about this movie. It's so much fun. When a movie understands that it only has to be what it wants to be. And this movie only is what it wants to be, which is silliness, fun, and just time after time of your jaw being agape going, I can't believe I just saw what I just saw. But yeah, it's a really fun watch, and I wanted to throw it out there that I agree. That it's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then I'll go on to mine, my second small recommend, which is The Final Girls from 2015. I actually ran across a trailer for this while I was watching a Blu-ray back in the day when they used to put all these millions of trailers on Blu-rays and everything. I guess they still do to somewhat, but I don't know. This one had like five or six trailers on it, and this one ran across, and I actually started watching the trailer, and I was like, you know what, I could probably get into that. And so yeah, this is a story about an actress who is at the beginning of the movie, she's looking for some work. She's only had one thing that she's known for, and it's this campy 1980s horror film that she was in. And we've sort of fast forwarded 20 years later to where she and her daughter are both sort of looking for work and everything. And so after another bad audition, they, go down the street, and, Malin Ackerman, who is here in the thumbnail that you're showing here, her daughter is played by Thaisa Farmiga. They get into a huge wreck. And then we're advanced 3 years later, and we find out that Malin Ackerman didn't survive the crash, and Thaisa Farmiga is just kind of like, you know, going through the motions and everything. But then she's invited by this this guy who's kind of a nerd of these horror movies that came out in the 80s, and they want to do this marathon at a theater. Thomas Middleditch plays that character. Goes and says, hey, you know, you want to come out and see this movie that's starring your mom? And oh, by the way, can you be in a Q&A afterwards and all this other stuff? And she sort of just reluctantly agrees to go to this thing. And in the middle of the showing, as would happen, someone spills a bottle of alcohol and somebody accidentally drops a match on it, and it sets the entire theater on fire while the movie's running. And to get safe, they cut a hole in the screen and they go behind the screen. And when they wake up, they're in the movie that they were watching.
Gun, gun, gun.
And so they have to decide. They have to figure out what they need to do. It's kind of got some tiny bit of Groundhog Day elements to it, because the movie goes a certain way, and if you know the movie well, then you need to make sure that you are that you're sticking to where the movie is. But then it kind of takes a different turn than that, than what you're thinking it's going to go. Anyway, Thaisa Farmiga gets to see her mom again, only she's playing a character this time and doesn't have any idea who she is. And so it's sort of that way of like a mother and daughter getting to see each other again in kind of like a blast from the past, a ghost, if you will. And so they have to survive this horror movie and to finally get back to to normal and everything. This movie is really fun. It's not a complete success by any means, but I really do like the premise, and I thought it was really fun. And I think people who like horror movies especially will like this too.
I think I like it too. I haven't seen it yet. It's been on my radar since it came out. I've had several people tell me it's my kind of horror movie, in that it's like meta and fun and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure I will eventually get around to this. I will add your recommend to the pile, pushing me to see it for sure.
Mm-hmm. All right. On to our big recommend, which is Lawrence of Arabia. We are continuing the series of movies that we've been recommended but do not like. I love Lawrence of Arabia, but is it possible that I hate Lawrence of Arabia now after watching it this time? Is it possible that Aaron loves Lawrence of Arabia after hating it before? Maybe he didn't hate it. And it just didn't appeal to him as much as other people or whatever. But anyway, did any of our opinions change after this movie? Stay tuned.
So just like you, I like to save money, and that's why when Mint Mobile came over to our little corner of the internet, I started to pay attention. And let me tell you, something interesting happened. I realized that I think I have an unhealthy relationship with my existing provider. I had to do this thing where it's like, should I try something new? No, I've been with this provider for so long. And then I got to looking at my bill and I thought, do I really want to keep spending this much money when it appears that Mint Mobile can do the exact same for $15 a month? And that's when I started to click around and find out. To get started, I did just what you can do. Go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. And then right there is where I saw the 3-month plans that were like $15 a month. And that includes the unlimited plan. All of the plans come with high speed data and unlimited talk and text, and they deliver all that on the nation's largest 5G network, which is great. Even better, you can use your own phone number. And I'm kind of, connected emotionally to my phone number. Another thing I probably should dig into in therapy. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. There is a $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Lawrence of Arabia, a 1962 David Lean film introducing the world to Peter O'Toole and starring Alec Guinness, Omar Sharif, and one of the greatest scores of all time. Which is a good thing, because if you thought 2 minutes of logos were bad, just wait till I introduce you to 5 minutes of music on black screen. After that, we get some more credits over an overhead shot of a motorcycle before T.E. Lawrence, who is played by Peter O'Toole, hops on his motorcycle and attempts to cheat death by going faster and faster until death eventually has had enough of being cheated and ends the game. Cut to Lawrence's funeral, where people are having various conversations about who he was and whether or not his exhibitionism matches up to Hugh Jackman's Greatest Showman. Someone mentions he worked for him, and we flash back to Lawrence showing off his pain threshold skills, because after all, the trick is apparently just not minding that it hurts. After Lawrence busts someone's billiard balls and proves he is a bit of an unconventional oaf, we land in an office where he's assigned the job to talk to an Arab prince about helping the war against the Germans and the Turks, even though the war is mostly in the trenches of Germany, and apparently this is a sideshow of a sideshow. Lawrence indicates how much fun he is going to have in the scorching heat by playing match-holding pyro again. But wait, that's not a match. That's a smash cut to the desert sunrise so we can get our first batch of desert porn, night sky porn, and camel porn. Well, not really camel porn, because that's unfortunately probably a real thing, but you know what I mean. After settling down with his guide for the evening, they bond over how fat everyone is back home, the gun that he gives him, and eating some food. And are we sure Lawrence isn't American? With some more desert scapes in between, we get some riding lessons, some binocular scouting, and some spotting the arriving of someone from miles away from an in-ground water source. In England, they would say, that's well spotted. After waiting too long to get the first shot off, the approaching stranger arrives and says that he owns the well, and they chit-chat about who owns what and who gets to know whose name and how people get angry when you shoot their friends. Lawrence then decides to find the rest of the way to Prince Faisal using his trusty compass instead of going back with the friend murderer. Lawrence then finds his way to some echoey cliffs where he steals a bit from the Alex Garland movie Men and tries to compose an echo song right there on the spot. It's there he's met by another English soldier sent by Faisal to lead him in. He tells Lawrence to keep his mouth shut before some loud explosions happen and a couple of biplanes plane by to engage in some light north by northwesting of the Arab encampment that they are headed towards. The company retreats away from the battle, and we get a quick lesson in what happens when you don't get proper consent from a camel to do butt stuff. Next up is a group powwow on how the British can help fight the Turks, where Obi-Wan, with an unfortunate makeup job, puts the British officer in his place, and Lawrence continues his independent streak by siding with Faisal over his military buddy. Lawrence and the prince then have a private conversation that leads to Lawrence saying he can help him make Arabia great again. Lawrence then has some me time in the dunes, but instead of worrying about the spice trade, he comes out with one word: Aqaba. Apparently his revelation is that they should go to Aqaba. This seems crazy to Ali, but is it so crazy that it just might work? Well, we're going to find out as Lawrence takes him in and heads that way with Faisal's approval. After a couple of young stowaways are caught, they have to make the call to risk going through the hardest part of the desert to get there. But of course they do it because the movie needs some more glorious shots of miles and miles of sand. On the route, they see some tornadoes, and Lawrence starts to fall asleep, dreaming of why he couldn't have Helen Hunt, Bill Paxton, and Philip Seymour Hoffman along for the fun. The group eventually realizes they should be traveling at night when it's cooler and resting during the heat of the day, and we get some day walking, some treacherous rock walking, and finally, an ultimatum to cross the sun's anvil before the heat of the next day kicks in, because they are out of time and resources. They do reach the other side in time. But then Lawrence's consciousness perks up a bit, and he realizes he has to go back to save someone who fell off during the night that the others have given up for dead. But of course, Lawrence does it and saves the day. And as the score swells, we get an extreme wide shot as two camels run to meet each other in the sands, as if lovers who have been separated but finally reunited. Or maybe I'm still thinking about the camel porn that I mentioned earlier. Either way, Lawrence is now welcomed back as a hero who says nothing is written, which is true because you don't have to write anything when you're this good at just telling the story through visuals. Lawrence is given the robes of a sharif, and while he's out playing pretend in the desert, he gets peeped on by a Howie Tattle tribal leader named Auda. Is that right? Auda?
I think that's right.
Yeah, I think it's Auda.
A-U-D-A?
Yeah. Auda, played by Anthony Quinn, who also seems to have put on too much makeup. After a bit of tension, Auda welcomes Lawrence and his crew in for a meal, where Lawrence convinces Auda to join them in ousting the Turks from Aqaba. On the way, there's an unfortunate blood feud killing that threatens the peace. In order to keep the peace, Lawrence himself offers to execute the man responsible. But as that man lifts his head, it's the same man he rescued from the desert earlier, and he realizes the painful contradictions and irony of war and conquest. After the army rides as easily into Aqaba as Lawrence suggests that they might, then the plan is hatched to get across the Sinai Desert to Cairo to let them know that Aqaba has fallen. Before he leaves, though, he must promise gold. He must promise some gold and guns to Auda in 10 days' time. Since the movie needs even more time in the sand, Lawrence gets his Moses on with the two orphan stowaways and sets out across Sinai. While navigating through a dust storm, Lawrence loses his compass, and instead of going back for it, he's like, screw it, I know the sun sets in the west, I got this. And then quicksand. That's right, guess it's real and deadly, and it swallows up one of the kiddos. Yet they eventually make it to Cairo, where Lawrence has a bit of difficulty convincing the higher-ups about what happened, and also just give them some lemonade already, will ya? But he eventually does, and he gets a new rank and the chance to admit that he may actually enjoy killing people now. Lawrence then gets the guys in suits to say that they have no interest in Arabia, but we know that's BS, even though Lawrence takes it at face value and gets his permission to go back and help England get the Turks out of Arabia. The generals then discuss whether they can really give him the artillery he needs, but are rudely interrupted by an intermission and another 5 minutes of black screen. Once we're back in action, we start with a reporter from Chicago who syndicated across America and who has a conversation with Prince Faisal about where Lawrence's brigade is and what they're doing. They then agree to literally and figuratively talk Turkey, and Faisal tells him Lawrence is destroying the Turkish railways and also how many have died at the hands of the enemy and also at the hands of their own people so that they wouldn't be captured. Smash cut to the reporter snapping pics of Lawrence and his rebels taking out a train and ransacking it, mostly for giant clocks, apparently. After a German soldier who survived takes aim with his gun and takes a shot at Lawrence that hits him, but then he unfortunately realizes he shot the Sharif, but he did not shoot him dead, you see. So he's dispatched by Blade, and the reporter laments that he didn't take a picture of that soldier finding his eventual end at the tip of that sword. Amongst some spontaneous Lawrence chants, our hero poses for a picture and then says it will take a golden bullet to kill him. It's already clear that Lawrence is getting a bit of a god complex, even before he says that he's the one who will give these people their freedom. After Otta helps Lawrence take out one more train, this one full of horses, he says he's got what he wants, so he's headed home. On a later mission, his remaining orphan helper is badly injured, and Lawrence himself has to kill him to keep him from being captured. Lawrence and Ali are then captured while scouting their next town in Dera. Lawrence is then oogled and prodded by the local Turkish bey, which triggers an outburst that results in a thorough thrashing and a realization that he may not be fit for the work he's doing. So he heads back to HQ. Here he finds out that the uppers have an agreement to put Arab forces in the Middle East for their own gain and then give that land to the French, which annoys him so much he agrees to lead the Arab forces into Damascus himself just so he can beat Allenby there and make sure to give it to the Arab forces instead. Lawrence is then back in full war mode as they slice their way to Damascus with his bloodthirst growing and unleashing on retreating Turkish soldiers as he adopts a soldier's cry of no prisoners with the mad passion of Faye Dunaway giving her opinion on wire hangers. Lawrence does beat Allenby to Damascus, but the Brits refuse to help administrate the city, and since the Arab army can't maintain the city, the English take it over, and Lawrence leaves with another useless rank promotion and the feeling that nothing he did mattered in the way he had hoped it would. And as a motorcycle passed him on the way back home, he's left with the realization that sometimes he actually does mind that it hurts. And that is Lawrence of Arabia. What'd you think this time through, Chris?
I still love this movie. I do think that the first 2 hours of this movie, leading all the way to the assault on Aqaba and all of that, is the best part of this movie. And then the rest of it has a hard time keeping up with what they set up right there in the middle. Because after that, we have him trying to destroy trains, and we have the torture scene, which is, you know, is it obviously affects his character a lot, but the movie has a hard time sort of keeping up with that level of what they were doing in the first half of it and everything. Still, I still enjoy that last half of the movie. It's just that it's one of those type of things where they kind of just shoot their load, so to speak, in the middle of the movie, and then in the rest of the movie you're kind of trying to keep up with that and everything. But You were in the synopsis you talked about him touching the match and everything, and the trick is not minding that it hurts. I don't think I had ever really thought of that as anything before until watching it the other day and realizing this is something that Lawrence does the entire movie, sort of like not minding that it hurts every single time. The very first time he hits the desert, It's so hot and oppressive, but he just soldiers on throughout the whole thing. And he does this constantly, just constantly does stuff that is probably against his, the best thing to do, basically, because especially when he goes back to get that, is it Gazim was his name? When he goes back to get that guy, that's probably really stupid, actually.
Yes.
To do that. And in fact, that's the thing, when you read about what actually happened in the real story, he did do this, but he was not welcomed back with this, wow, what a hero. Everybody was just kind of like, That was dumb. You shouldn't have done that. You could have like ruined this whole thing for us.
Yeah.
But it in the movie, it's great. It's a great moment in the movie. And even though that didn't really happen the way they say it does, it is a tremendous part. I love all of this cinematography. It's hard to really mess this up because you're out in the middle of the desert and the deserts just go on forever. But they shoot this in 70 millimeter and you can see like you can see for miles. Yeah. Behind, you don't see very many movies do this anymore. You just see miles and miles beyond. Like there's a mountain range that's deep in there and you're like, oh, even further. You can see one even further than that.
Yeah.
That's how far this thing goes. So like during this journey, I'm enjoying this journey. I know that it's a walking movie. It's something we recently dealt with. I guess recent's a bad is not the right word these days for Lord of the Rings, but Lord of the Rings was a big walking movie, and mm-hmm. and of course it had a lot of action that sort of like offset all of that walking, whereas Lawrence of Arabia doesn't have that much action and everything. But still, I'm enjoying that ride that we're taking all the way through this. I love his strategy of taking Aqaba, even though again that's not the way it happened in real life,
right.
Unfortunately. But yeah. This is such a great thing that they're leading up to here. That shot of them going in and just taking the city basically unopposed,
yeah.
And then ending on the shot of the guns that they've been talking about,
yep.
This whole time. The guns that you can't attack this place because of, they've completely circumvented it by going in behind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love all of that. Going to the notes, he's like, yes, cinematography, of course, is amazing. The music is great. I even heard that even though this got nominated for, 10 awards or something like that, and I think it won 7, they didn't get a costume nomination because they didn't submit the name.
Oh,
that was a crazy thing. Let's see. I've gone over most of that 2-hour stuff. I love almost everything about that. I love the movie showing the difficulty of getting people together for a common goal when everybody has their own selfish goals. And of course, Lawrence does too. That was a depiction that the Lawrence family did not enjoy at all, that he was this guy who became bloodthirsty and everything. They didn't like that. But I do think in a movie that's completely correct for his character to kind of get to that point. He's gone through a lot. He's had to deal with a lot of politics. He gets tortured and it looks like he's looking for his own glory in this. I don't know if it's really like he's doing it for the Arabs. He's not doing it for the British for sure. But he really does seem like he's kind of just doing it for his own personal thing, and he's not looking for any accolades. He just wants that to be something that he can say, I did that. Cause that's what he says when they take Aqaba. He goes, I did that, instead of saying a whole bunch of like tribes that I got to get to get or two tribes that I got to get together to do it. He's the one who's he's like, I did that at the end of it. So I love all this whole thing where there's so many different interests going on, and it's nearly impossible to get everybody to agree. And I'm glad that the movie shows how hard that is when everybody's got their own interests involved in a battle. That comes to a head later, of course, when he has the Arab Council and he's trying to get that government set up in, is it Jerusalem or is it Damascus? I can't remember which one it was.
At the end, they're taking Damascus.
Yeah, it's Damascus. So when he gets all of these people in the room, and even the two guys he's been fighting along this whole time, they can't even agree on anything right off the bat. How are you going to get these thousands of people who are in the same room together on one thing? And that was another astonishing thing to watch about this movie, is watching how many extras were in that scene. Like, now you'd want to do a scene like that, you're going to have a bunch of like CGI guys, yeah. Running around and everything. It's so clear that they got real. I mean, of course they got real people. They didn't have any other option, but like, God, what a crazy thing to do these days. In the acting department, I love Peter O'Toole, but I do think Omar Sharif kind of steals it for me. He's so good in this. And And reading sort of the behind the scenes, he was a hero behind the scenes too, getting a lot of the stuff done and getting some of the politics, because they had to shoot in some places that they didn't think they were going to get some people in because of their religious affiliation. So that he was able to like grease the wheels on a lot of things behind the scenes and everything. And Alec Guinness has great moments too, but of course, you know, you would never do what they did with Alec Guinness in this movie today. Yeah, ultimately really love this. I do think it could probably use a trim here and there, but man, you're talking about 1960s epic filmmaking, 70 millimeter, all of that. It's gonna have some excess. I don't know where I would necessarily cut it, but it probably could use a few here and there. I think it still deserves to be a 3-hour movie, though.
Yeah, I will say while I'm thinking about it, since you just mentioned the brown facing that's going on in this movie with Guinness and Quinn. And probably many other actors as well, you know, as like secondary actors and stuff. But one of the interesting behind the scenes things that I saw was Omar Sharif was almost not cast as well. It was almost accidental that they actually found somebody to actually play a role from the race that they were portraying. So I found that interesting. This is still not one of my favorite movies of all time. However, it has gone up quite a few notches in my estimation watching it again. And I think I was able to, and this happens with a second viewing sometimes, when you're experiencing something for the first time, you get bogged down in your initial reactions, right? So like, for instance, I'm watching this and I'm like, okay, I get it. We're traveling through the sand. Can we, you know, get to the next part of the story? And so then the next time it goes back to another traveling through the sand, I'm like, are you serious? And then I'm so distracted by that I'm not paying due attention to some of the other things I'm able to in a second viewing. And I'm pretty much right with you. I think the movie's only real flaw is that I don't know that it's the length per se. I think it's structured awkwardly. I think there's a real awkwardness to the ebb and flow of what I'm interested in this movie and what it's trying to do. Not only is that second half a little bit anticlimactic, it also just kind of jumps around a lot through Lawrence's life. Like we're taking down trains. Now we're in a torture scene. Now we're doing like, and it happens so like jump in such a jumbled way. That I think there's just an awkwardness to the structure that doesn't allow the movie to hit perfectly for me. Having said all that, I was able so much more this time to really appreciate the beauty of this movie to take in. And you say it's hard to mess up desert shots, and I think you're right, but it's also there's some real keen talent in the framing of what's going on here. I was very aware of how beautiful some of the framing was. I watched a couple little featurettes afterwards. Martin Scorsese was talking about his love for this film, and Spielberg was talking about his love for this film. And look, you know, if Scorsese and Spielberg are on the same page, who am I to say that they are wrong? Both of them mentioned the mirage shot, the mirage scene, and it is such a spectacular shot, and apparently very difficult to do and get right.
Apparently, it required some outrageously weird millimeter lens that they used for that shot, and it never has been used again. I think they took it and basically, I don't know where it is now. I don't know where the lens is, but it has never been used since. And I guess the reason it's never been used since is not because of it being a legendary lens at this point. It's just that it has that very specific, it has that very specific skill making a mirage. And how many times do you really need to do that unless you're like specifically I want to do something just like Lawrence of Arabia did, you know? So I don't know, but that I thought that was a fun thing that that lens has never been used since.
It's amazing. There's so many great stories about this movie and that particular scene as well. The idea that so many of these shots that, you know, you look at and you go, oh, that's amazing, the pure sand or whatever. And then you think, they had to do those shots more than once. So they had to clear all that sand every, like, they had to, like, like, you know, field guys on a baseball field, you know, sweep in the sand for miles. That is like a mile long shot. And also they, I guess, painted a line on the ground in that shot to draw the eye towards where they wanted it to go on the horizon. So, like, there's this lighter sand that kind of draws the eye all the way, the perspective to the end. Like, that kind of stuff is always interesting to me, and I just love that kind of stuff. So, yes, it's beautiful. Performances are great. I agree Omar Sharif steals the movie. I think he's spectacular in this, and I do think Peter O'Toole is good. I was thinking with the structure, which I mentioned, I think might be the biggest negative for me, and it, and why the length doesn't quite work for me, is there's this interesting introduction of Lawrence through the funeral, right? We get this interesting, I really like the beginning of this movie. It sets up every, a lot of things you need to know about Lawrence, is that he doesn't care. He's, you know, strange. He's, you know, wants to cheat death, all those things.
Kind of a Citizen Kane kind of opening.
Sure, sure. And then there's there's somebody who at the funeral says, oh, I think the guy worked for me. And then we cut to him working for that guy. And I thought in my mind, because I couldn't remember, I was like, oh, do they cut back to the funeral and other people who knew him and then go to that person's perspective, or, like, you know, kind of piece it together through, you know, people talking about him at the funeral? And we really don't, we don't ever go back to the funeral, which is a bit unfortunate, because we have learned so much about those people who are saying those things at the funeral, and it's given so much added context that when you watch it again, you're like, oh, this is the guy where this thing happens later. And I just I just wondered if we could have gone back there a couple times to see those
people. I agree.
I
was sitting there thinking about that, because, like, all these different opinions come flying at you at the beginning. You don't know anything about the character at that point. And then once it gets further along, you're like, oh, there's that guy who said he shook his hand in Damascus once. And you're like, but now I've got to figure out who are the other guys and what did they do?
Right.
And why do they think that way about him? And yeah, it might have been better to take the Citizen Kane route on this, where, you know, that someone is just kind of like, you know, you have your reporter like you have in this one. By the way, love that dude's voice.
So fun. Yeah.
The reporter, like, he has that voice, you know. He's like
Chicago,
that old
reporter.
School.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The, you know, him going to each character and saying, what do you remember about Lawrence? And it just kind of tells you the story in that way. And I think you're right. I think that would have been an amazing way to tell the story. And maybe they thought about doing that, and they just were like, well, it's too much like Citizen Kane, or whatever the reason was. But I agree with you. I think it would have been a more exciting and dynamic story, especially since, again, we have told the most exciting part of it by the middle of the movie. That could have been the end of the movie right there, and we could have just told that story out of order. But maybe they, I don't know, they weren't thinking about that then, or just we want to tell this more straightforward. So.
And I think the reason that's not the end, because I think the movie's purpose is in telling Lawrence's story is to arrive at the sadness of his story, at the pointlessness of it to him, and. I think that's an admirable, you know, line to draw. But if you end it at the conquering, then it's like all hail the conquering hero is the story. Mm-hmm. And that's not the story they wanted to tell about Lawrence. They wanted to tell a story. And this is another thing I appreciated so much more this time through, because the first time through, I remember feeling, not only did it feel like it dragged on, but it felt like I don't care. Like, I don't want to like this guy. I don't care about this guy. I, like, you know, what is this movie telling me that means something? And I missed a lot of this because I was thinking the movie was wanting this to be a conquering hero story, and it's not. And ultimately what we're learning, I think, from the portrayal of Lawrence here is that war damages everyone. War damages people there, in that it is something that continues to happen across the world throughout history at all times, because power draws people to do terrible things. But it is always damaging. And, you know, the idea that these people, you know, some of these people were blowing up their own transportation system, right? They're blowing up their own train tracks because in their mind, and I read some stuff afterwards, in their mind, this is temporary. We'll do this to capture this city and then, you know, get back to normal or whatever. And guess what? Those train tracks never repaired. Never. Mm-mm. They lost 100 years of progress through war. Yeah. And it's just, it's so sad. And I think the movie knows that and wants to allow us to get there with the Lawrence character.
In fact, there was a piece of trivia I saw on this that said that when they went out to shoot some of this, they saw some of the old track that actually blew up and everything when they were going out to shoot that thing. That's a crazy,
it's wild
coincidence. Yeah,
it's wild. So they wanted to show how not only did war change him, but that that there was this part of him that he struggled with because he liked it. And so I just think there's a lot of character work that the movie is doing. The movie also, and I've heard David Lean talk about this, so this isn't just me surmising this, although I did surmise it and then heard some of what Lean had to say about it. There's some really interesting sexuality undertones with the T.E. Lawrence character. And if you do some research on the actual T.E. Lawrence and what he was into, let's just say, when he got, you know, back from the war, that trauma torture scene takes on a whole new light as to how it impacted the stuff with the young stowaway boys takes on a whole new impact in light of those things. Like there's a lot of, and Lean said that was his intention. He's on record as saying like there, you know, I wasn't specifically saying he was, you know, this or that. I was just, offering that this is who he was.
Yeah, that torture scene offers some subtleties into that. Like, it's one of those things that old movies could do so well, is kind of indicate that that's what they were heading towards without actually ever spelling it out. Mm-hmm. And so for most normal audiences, it was like, oh, he's getting tortured. That's terrible. But then there's other people who could read into it and say, oh, there's a little bit more to this than the, just the surface and everything. They used to do that quite a bit back in the day. So anyway.
And then the only other thing I wanted to say was I'm a Bridge on the River Kwai guy. I love
that's a
that
great movie.
And so I do have a soft spot for David Lean. But I also think Dr. Zhivago is just a complete miss.
I've never met anybody who likes Dr. Zhivago, and I hate it too. The movie has this tremendous like reputation, even on the IMDb. I think it's at the 8.0 or something like that. And I still have never found anybody who actually likes it. It's a sleeping pill, man.
Yeah. But Bridge on the River Kwai, if you're going to see, in my opinion, one David Lean movie, that's the one. And then Lawrence of Arabia is certainly worth seeing too. But that's it. That's all I
love that one too. And I was an eyelash of making that next week's movie, but I went a different way. Okay. Went a different way. Anyway, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I think this is a fairly basic one. I was trying to, think of, some complex, like out there ones and everything. But in the end, the whole white guy goes into a native, tribe or whatever, and then becomes one of them. Dances with Wolves is the one that, came up to me the most in all of this. I have not actually seen Dances with Wolves in forever, but, it's that thing where he's fighting in the Civil War. And then I can't remember if he gets, recommissioned or whatever, but he ends up spending his time with a native tribe, somewhere out West. And then he sort of goes native and he likes to, you know, be in that world more than he likes to be in the American imperial world that he's been fighting for and everything. So that's the one that I went with on that one.
Great choice. Great choice. I also like, who was it? Slab's Choice in the chat, who says Ishtar. That would be a fun double feature.
Well. Ishtar's, you know what? One day, I hope this happens. Someone makes a behind the scenes movie about Ishtar because the behind the scenes of Ishtar, way more interesting than the actual movie Ishtar, even though Ishtar has gotten kind of a cult following in the last few years.
I'm in that cult following.
And,
I enjoy that.
Yeah, I've never been able to join that cult. I've watched it several times. but yeah, I want to see a story about the making of Ishtar one day.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Is insane. Okay. Going on to what we're going to see, let's see, what's our next week's homework. I am going to go back to the roots of this show, which is to find movies maybe you haven't seen and recommend those to you. We have been doing a lot of bangers lately. I want to go back to why this show, I think, was created. And I'm going to finally introduce all of you who have not seen it to Zero Effect, this movie from 1998 that I have talked about for years, but I've never been able to go down and dissect for an audience before. This movie is fantastic. I love it so much. Bill Pullman, probably his best performance of his career, I'm going to say. And then Ben Stiller taking a supporting role in a period of time where he was becoming a huge comedy star. Kim Dickens is fantastic in this movie too. So this is kind of a Sherlock Holmesian movie. It's directed by Jake Kasdan, Lawrence Kasdan's kid. This movie is so good, and I can't wait to introduce it to you who have not seen it. Aaron, have you seen this movie?
I am one of those who have not seen it. So I am excited to check it out. And I'm always down for some Stiller and Pullman. That's amazing.
Mm. Yeah. Also, another a great performance from Ryan O'Neal in this one, too,
nice.
Who kind of comes out of nowhere in this movie. But, another good one. All right. I guess we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
All right. Let's see. What movie has the single best score?
I think that's a great question for this week, because you could argue that Lawrence of Arabia is in that conversation. It is certainly an incredible score. I always, when I think of this question, just go back to, like, what am I pumped to just hum through my day? Like, what it just stays with me and sticks with me? And I'm going with Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
It is so epic, triumphant. I love that score. So that if push came to shove and I had to off the top of my head pick something, it's Raiders. However, this would be a really fun conversation to have with a bunch of people, because I can imagine somebody being like, what about this? And me being like, yeah, I'll take that. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many great scores, but I'm going with Raiders.
Yeah, this is always going to be one of those tough ones where there's somebody will come up with 10 better ones by the time you're done with your answer. But I'm going to tell you what Jeremy was going to say if Jeremy was still on the program at this point in time, because his answer was my answer. But he chose The Untouchables, which is one of my favorite scores of all time. Ennio Morricone, you can't go wrong with that guy. Mm-hmm. That guy did some great ones. Because Jeremy picked The Untouchables, I'm going to go with Psycho as mine. Psycho has such a great score. Not just, of course, the ones that we know, the music that we know and love, but I just love that. It's so good. So, those are a couple of my favorite scores, and Going over to the chat, let's see what do we got here. We've got the Prince of Egypt as a great score. I remember songs from Prince of Egypt. I haven't seen the Prince of Egypt in a while, but what do you remember about the score on the Prince of Egypt? Is that a great score to you?
Yes, it is a great score, but I probably wouldn't have it in this conversation. I would have it in the conversation of best soundtracks, right? Is that the difference?
Yeah, you know.
What I mean, like,
right, like it's the songs are the thing that about the
Deliver Us is one of the best movie songs ever written. It's so good. Yeah. And there are several bangers in that movie, so yeah. The score is great, but I don't remember it enough to think that it's would be in this conversation for me. So yeah,
but Castor's got several of them here. The Incredibles, which I believe is Michael Giacchino. Mm-hmm. He's also Tron Legacy, which is a great great score as well. Polly says gonna say in Indy or Star Wars original. You can't go wrong with John Williams, honestly. John Williams has so many great ones. In fact, he's got great ones. He's got great ones that like are not Spielberg. Like JFK's score is amazing. you can't really go wrong with him. Slab says A New Hope and Jurassic Park was on repeat as a kid, plus Wrath of Khan. Staying with John Williams, Superman, that's what Flyboy says. James says I spent years saying Ratatouille, but it has recently swung to The Village. Ooh, The Village does have a good score, I'll give it that. Shaggy Nut says Dark Knight. Nolan says Halloween has an amazing score. John Carpenter in general, I love all of his his scores. They're very distinct. There's hardly anything that, I don't know, would you consider a John Carpenter score beautiful at all, but it's always affecting and everything. Love those. Josh says my instincts are Social Network, Gone Girl, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, Challengers, or any of that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross did. Actual answer is Alan Silvestri's Back to the Future. Yes, absolutely great. Nolan says Jaws is also iconic. We're still talking about John Williams because this guy, did a lot of great ones. Slab also says Catch Me If You Can. Polly says Nightmare Before Christmas. And there you go. Those are some great answers for that question. And
I love it.
So, yeah.
I love it when, I'll just add this real quick. I love it when you're just catching up on movies. They aren't necessarily like movies that are well known or going to be in people's top 100 or whatever. And a score just like stands out to you is like, this is really good. And I don't know the last time you watched Open Range, the Kevin Costner movie, but I watched that recently.
We actually did a big recommend. It was one of Jeremy's big recommends when we first started on Wreckatopia, but I don't remember the score.
I just watched this movie recently, and I just remember going, this score is kind of amazing. And I didn't even look, I should have looked up who did it, but yeah, it's just I love that feeling of just like, oh, I kind of want to play this score on repeat. This is really good stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Next week, we're going to go to Zero Effect. Finally, I can't wait to rewatch this movie under this format and everything. And I'm glad that Aaron is going to get a chance to see this for the first time. So, people were asking where Zero Effect could be found. I think Hoopla again is to the rescue on that. Otherwise, you would have to rent it from the various places that you rent movies. But I believe Hoopla is the free one. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you, chat, for coming out and watching us talk movies today. You guys are so valuable. I appreciate you so much. That's going to do it today. We'll see you next time. See you next week. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Anything in the world happening these days? Any stories that have been dominating?
I'll tell you.
Brain space.
I'll tell you this. On Sunday, I was contemplating on what I wanted to get done for the day. I wanted to, the plan was I was going to try to get 30 minutes of a script done and watch Lawrence of Arabia in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And then I had to do stuff at night. So that was my plan. Get 30 minutes of the movie done, get Lawrence of Arabia started. When I woke up, I was like, if I go too far today and don't watch Lawrence of Arabia today, then I don't know if I will get a chance to watch it Monday, because mm-hmm. Monday was another day where I had to bring my mom to an appointment. So I didn't know what was going to go on Monday. So I started Lawrence of Arabia in the morning on Sunday. And it was about halfway through when that news dropped about Kamala Harris and Biden and all this stuff. And I had everybody in the world texting me. I'm exaggerating. It just seemed like everybody in the world just started texting or doing something on Slack or whatever. And so I was like, oh, okay. I'm so glad that I started watching Lawrence of Arabia when I did.
Right.
I didn't know what Monday was going to hold. Monday turned out I could have watched it yesterday too, but
sure.
But God, I was so glad that I got that movie watched, or at least halfway watched at the point that all that went down. So,
yeah.
So that was a thing.
Yeah, it was a thing. It was one of those. It's interesting. I often kind of think back over my life, my long life now. I'm an old man now, Chris. I don't know if you know this. I'm an old man now.
That's true. It's very true.
But my long life, and think of like those moments that stand out, like where I'm just going to remember, you know, oh, this moment was big enough that it locked my location in geography into my brain. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I don't know if a sitting president stepping down instead of being reelected will be that. Like, it's too early to tell. But
right.
But in that moment, it felt like one of those things. Like, you know, mm-hmm. January 6th, I will always remember how that, you know, unfolded in my day. September 11th, I will always remember how that unfolded in my day. It's just interesting that, you know, history has those moments that just kind of lock in for some reason.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I was trying to think.
I don't actually remember too much about January. The only thing about January 6th that I remember was that I was writing a script for something that day. Yeah. And I was deeply involved in that, and I was hearing some blips come through.
Right, right, yeah.
And I was like, ah, yeah, typical. They're out just protesting. That's what I thought.
Right.
And I didn't know the full scale of things until way later in the afternoon. So.
Yeah, I was actually in this room, and I walked out. This is like 3 years ago now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of my boys were home, and we went upstairs and we sat on the couch and watched history happen, and just in mm-hmm. awe and shock, and just like, where do I live again? I'm so confused mm-hmm. right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll just always remember those moments. And there's so few of them, right? Like I rack my brain for other ones. Like I think, of course, of like the shuttle disaster. But I was a kid then, and you know, was in school when that happened. You know, watching it on TV. So of course that one's going to be locked in.
See, that's what kills me. I don't know what the hell our school was doing, because we didn't watch it.
Oh,
we did not. I was at recess when this happened, and it was my birthday too. We came back after recess and our teacher told us what happened, and then we watched news from that point forward. But like, yeah, we didn't watch it, but everybody I know was like, that day we were watching the shuttle. I was like, what? I didn't even know there was a shuttle being launched that day. I don't believe.
That's wild, because the whole point of Christy McAuliffe going up was for educational purposes for schools.
They were
like, that was the whole
suppressing
thing.
Suppressing it. They were suppressing it in my school, man. Either that, or I was just completely. It could be. I mean, I, I fully admit I could have been oblivious to what there might have been talk about it all over the place. And I was just like, what about the Bears and the Patriots and the Super Bowl, huh? Yeah.
Let's get some kickball going, guys.
Exactly.
Oh, man, I remember kickball in grade school. Kickball and foursquare and tetherball. Those were like the three like Olympic sports of grade school at my school. It was like, if you could excel at those, you were the king of recess.
Played kickball, did not play foursquare, knew what tetherball was, never played tetherball.
It's
what is foursquare?
Oh, foursquare is this brilliant game. Maybe this is just a Michigan thing. I don't know. But foursquare is a game where you paint four squares on the ground and they are connective. So it's like one big square that's divided into four quadrants.
Sure. Okay.
And there's a player in each quadrant. You play it with a kickball style ball, so a bouncy ball, and you have to hit the ball into somebody else's square. It has to land in their square, and then they have to return it into somebody else's square. So if the ball ever hits your square, you're responsible to hit it into somebody else's square. And so,
are you defending your square?
Yes. So like you. Okay. So there's like a king square, and then there's, you know, rotate the other squares, the two square, the three square, and the four square, and then there's a line of people waiting to get into play. So like if you're in three square and you get out, four square moves up to three square, and the next person comes in. So yeah, you know, and king always serves. King square always serves. So yeah, it's just kind of one of those weird playground games that was just like big at our school. I didn't realize it was a regional thing, but maybe it is.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think that was played at my school.
Yeah.
Or various schools. I'm just now hearing of it now. There's so many things out there. It doesn't matter how long you've lived on this earth. There are things out there that you didn't know existed. It was a sort of discussion I was having yesterday. Like, got sent a video of, like, there's apparently some West Coast swing dancing competitions out there where, you know, people, they draw numbers. They're almost randomly put, I think they're randomly put together as dance partners, and then some random song is played that they have to dance to, and that's the competition. So, like, the one that I was sent was, like, the Macarena. So these two people had to do a dance to that was not the Macarena. And so I was like, man, there's so many things out there though, that you just, there are probably hundreds of thousands of people who revolve their lives around something you have never heard of before. And I was talking about, like, you know, recently this slap league has become like a huge thing.
Yeah.
Slapping.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing.
It is a huge thing.
And then a few years ago I was at a poker game and somebody threw on a video of like this, it's like a tag team fighting competition where you have, I guess, five on each side, and then they tell you to go, and then they go all, everybody goes out and just picks somebody to start fighting, and it's free for all. It doesn't matter, there's not really rules. Really doesn't look like. I mean, maybe there are probably rules, but like, they're just, it's just, it's chaos and everything. And then you think about stuff too. Also, did you ever see that tickling documentary?
Oh yeah. Yes.
Like, of course, that was like, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who's not seen it, but that one, I mean, that just blew my mind. Tickling. So there's how many other things out there right now are there that's just going on out there that you've never heard of, but hundreds of thousands of people. And I keep it to hundreds of thousands. Maybe it's millions, but like, I feel like it's got to be in that range for it to be popular enough, but for me not to hear about it.
Yeah. Stuff just like, it bubbles up, right? Like, it's interesting how cultural just kind of moves something to the forefront. You know, like, I could go back to King of Kong. I didn't know competitive King Kong, you know, video game or Donkey Kong, excuse me, video game was a thing until that documentary.
No, I didn't either. I mean, I always assumed that with video games, nobody was in some sort of active competition. It was just like someone out there is like, oh, well, I like Donkey Kong. I'll start playing that and I'll see if I can break the record. And then they call Guinness about it. Mm-hmm. Not that there was like all sorts of this politics and
right
and everything. That guy, Billy Mitchell, man, he's been in all, I mean, ever since that documentary came out, that there's been so many other revelations about Billy Mitchell and about what was the site that I can't remember what the site's called.
I don't know.
It was heavily involved in the mm-hmm. the scoring and like verification of all these scores, and of course they were corrupt too, and Billy Mitchell's been in so many lawsuits lately because he just does all this frivolous shit.
Yeah,
I should probably even stop talking about him because he's probably thinking about suing me right now.
David Ferrier was the guy that did the Tickled documentary. I got a chance at Fantastic Fest a couple years ago to see his next documentary or whatever. It was called Mr. Organ. Have you heard anything about this?
No.
So he did this documentary on this, just basically this weird guy, and it got weirder and weirder and weirder, and now he's like fearing for his life. It's a really interesting documentary, but I don't think it ever really got picked up. I think you can like VOD it. I think it's, you know, like $5 to rent or something like that. But that's, if you liked the Tickled documentary and you kind of like his style of digging into weird things, Mr. Organ is right along, you know, kind of that alley. So, yeah.
Well, and you never know what's going to take off as a topic, too. Like, remember Catfish?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
I remember the trailer for Catfish, and I thought it was a horror thing because that came out during that period of time where there was a lot of paranormal activity mm-hmm. and all this other stuff. So I thought it was a horror movie shot with, you know, found footage and things like that. So that's what I thought Catfish was. Before I didn't investigate it or anything before I watched it, and then I watched the movie and I was like, oh, well, that's still messed up, but I thought it was going to go completely different direction, but like that turned into like that
an industry,
entered the public. Yes. like that was something that I had never heard of before, and then suddenly, well, I think I had heard of people pretending
sure,
to be other
of course,
people
yeah.
but not to that level where they're like taking on entire like people's lives and mm-hmm. stuff. That's just insane.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Oh yes. The internet, you have given us so many wonderful things.
Yes. Yes, it has.